Welcome to Growing Bolder. Over the next 60 minutes, you will meet people who are going to show you how to get more out of life than you ever thought possible. These are ordinary people who made some simple changes that started them on a journey and gave them the courage to open the door to some thoughts and dreams they never thought possible or had given up on long before. I'm Mark Middleton. The fellow over there in the lime jumpsuit is Bill Schaefer, asking you to give us just an hour and see what happens.
Do you like the tie also, the lavender?
I do like that.
In a minute, we're going to talk to the greatest impressionist of our time. Rich Little is here to help bring back a classic. Then we're going to learn how to navigate the world of long-term medical care with information that everybody needs to know. Also, what do you think? Did Oswald act alone? The host of History Decoded is here with some unexpected twists. Then, the first successful female rock radio host ever, Carol Miller, is here with some inside information. So, are you ready? It's time to start growing bolder.
Well, we've got a special treat for you now because we're going to welcome Cary Grant, John Wayne, Jimmy Stewart, Johnny Carson, 10 presidents, and about 186 other major stars, because they are all wrapped up into the incredible voice of just one person. He's one of the greatest impressionists of our time and has an incredible career spanning over 50 years.
Yeah, I guess he's been on a few shows. Maybe you saw him once or twice on, let's see what, Ed Sullivan, Jackie Gleason, Glenn Campbell, Ronan Martin's Laugh-In, and about 1,000 times on The Tonight Show. He's done 9 comedy albums and 3 HBO specials, and now he's on Growing Bolder. Thrilled to say hi to a classic, the great Rich Little. How are you?
I'm fine. Doing well.
Hey, listen, first and foremost, you're here to let us know that one of the greatest series ever is now available on DVD. They were rude, funny, spontaneous. They featured some of the funniest people of all time. We're talking about the Dean Martin Celebrity Roasts.
Yeah. They're out now and you get them on DVD, and there's quite a lot of them.
And given the exploding interest in that genre, Rich, I mean, they're roasting everybody these days, and you were kind of the pioneer of all that. Why has it taken so long for these things to see the light of day?
Well, they came out in VHS, you know, for a long time, and they're just bringing them up to date by bringing them out on DVD. But you could get them on VHS. I had them all on VHS. And I guess they're so popular, and the requests, were so demanding that they decided to put them out on DVD. I mean, a lot of people watch them. I tell people about them, and they, of course, remember them and say, yeah, they want the kids to look at them and see some of the great comedians of all time. And so there's a big interest in them, because it was an era that's gone, it'll never be the same. You know, I mean, we don't have those kind of comedians or actors anymore, so they're kind of collector's items, and young people are curious, and the older people remember them when they first came out. So, you know, it's nostalgia time, really.
You know, Rich, I think one of the reasons that everybody does love you and always has is you've always come across as being just a big a fan of the people that you do, as we are. Who were some of your favorite stars, personally?
Oh, well, I mean, I had a number of people that I really warmed up to and got to know. Jimmy Stewart, I knew very well. We did a lot of things together. And then I ended up doing a one-man show on his life, which I am currently doing now, touring the country, doing a one-man show on Jimmy Stewart called Rich Little and Friends. And we're going to take it to Broadway next year. So that's been exciting. The other celebrity that I use that term loosely, was the president, President Reagan. I knew Reagan quite well, and spent a lot of time with him, and performed at the White House many times when he was president. And I knew him, as well as I knew Jimmy. And so, both being Republicans, I'd see them together a lot, And then Reagan would always try and imitate Jimmy Stewart. And he liked to do John Wayne, too. And he'd say to me, "Well, Rich, what do you think of my Jimmy Stewart?" I used to say, "Well, you know, don't give up your day job. It wasn't that great, but it was okay." But when he did Truman Capote, that's what really floored me. One time, the president did Truman Capote for me, and I thought that was pretty bizarre. He did a fairly good Truman Capote. And, matter of fact, I even gave him a joke to use, and he said to me, "Well, Rich, thanks for that joke. I'll use that." He said, "I can't wait to try that out on Gorbachev." And that's what he said. And I said, "What?" I would have given a year's pay to see that. You know, President Reagan doing Truman Capote for Gorbachev? That would be something to see. Probably wouldn't know what the hell he was doing.
That's a great story. We're talking with Rich Little, folks, one of the greatest impressionists of all time. And Rich, obviously, an impressionist has got to be immersed in popular culture. That's where so much of your material comes from. Are you developing any new material these days? Is there anybody out there, that's really popular today that makes you want to do an impression of them?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm always wide open to do new voices. Some of the younger movie stars are hard to do. You know, it's hard to do Brad Pitt. I don't think you could do George Clooney. You know, or Matt Damon. That would be pretty difficult. You know, I've been watching that series Breaking Bad, which I think is fabulous. And I can do most of the people on that show, so I might put that in the act soon. And you've got to keep a little up to date, because if you just do voices that are from a long time ago, you know, people think you're a little outdated. So the only reason that I do the voices from the past are they were easy to do because they were all larger than life, and they all were identifiable, you know. And as I said, you got the movie stars of today, and they're a lot tougher to do.
Who on Breaking Bad would you say you'd want to do most? I mean, is it Jesse Pinkman? Is it Heisenberg? Who do you like to do?
Oh, Heisenberg. I could do him, yeah.
Can you give us just a little bit how you would do Heisenberg?
Do you know the show?
I do.
Jesse. I will not do that, and we're not going to cook until we have a maid. Who's going to clean up? And then Jesse says,
"No, that's good."
Rich, you know, Rich, you're amazing. And aside from your talent, you know, sometimes I think that you feel like a trained seal. You know, somebody throws you a mackerel and says, "Do a voice." But you've got an incredibly fresh.
Yeah, I had a guy come up to me in the grocery store the other day. He had a lisp and a bulbous nose. He looked like W.C. Fields. And he said, "I bet you can't imitate me." I said, "Yeah, I bet I can." I said, "I could do him." And he said, "Martha, come here. The guy does me. I'm going to be famous. Jeez, I can't believe this."
But, you know, one of the things that we admire the most about you, Rich, is you're in your mid-70s. You could have packed it in and just, you know, sailed off and bought yourself an island and lived out your time.
Yeah, but, well, I've thought about that.
But, but you have thought about it, but you don't because you love what you do still.
Yeah, I do. Well, as George Burns said years ago, he said, "Rich, you know, you've got to have a reason to get out of bed in the morning, or you've got to have a reason to get into bed." You know. So, you know, you got to keep busy. That's the thing, you know. And I'm not doing TV like I used to because they want younger people. But I'm doing a lot of shows, doing the Jimmy Stewart show and doing my nightclub act. So I'm touring a lot of the country and still performing and still drawing crowds, which is great. But, you know, they're an older audience. And And, you know, some of the young people think I'm Little Richard.
Rich, when you do somebody's voice, I mean, you're actually trying to capture the essence of them. And I'm guessing that it really more than just the voice becomes part of you. Do you somehow learn something from people? And you do great people. I guess what I'm trying to ask, have you been transformed in any way by the positive personality characteristics of many of the people that you've done impressions of?
That's a strange question. You're asking me what again now?
Well, I'm sorry to ask you a strange question. When you do somebody, rather than just imitating their voice, is there something about their personality that you also can adapt, that you can learn from?
Well, yeah. You know, I mean, if you have a great personality, they're easy to impersonate, you know. They don't have any personality. It's very tough. And of course, you know, when you do an impression, you exaggerate slightly. So, you know, it's interesting. It depends on who you're doing, really. I think some of my best impressions are probably Johnny Carson and John Wayne and Reagan, and then I was known for doing Richard Nixon for so many years. My own parents tried to have me impeached. You know, my nose kept growing, and I kept lying all the time when I was younger. But I did Nixon once in front of him, and it wasn't my finest moment. And this was down in San Clemente, way early in my career. Gosh, I was in my 20s, and we're down at San Clemente with a whole bunch of celebrities, and Debbie Reynolds dragged me around the swimming pool, threw me at the back of President Nixon and said, "Do him." And he thought I was going to shoot him, so he turned around, total fright. And I started to imitate Nixon in front of him, and everybody was gagging because he wasn't laughing. And, oh, my gosh, it was embarrassing. He just was staring, you know.
Oh, man.
And John Wayne was there, and he said, "Somebody get a rope," you know.
and Rich Little.
And he said, "Gee, I was so nervous, I ate a flower." But anyway, Nixon didn't know I was doing it. And he turned to his wife, Pat, and he said, why is this young man speaking in a strange voice?" And he just didn't know I was doing them, and as I said, everybody was gagging and just laughing with their hands, and he never knew. Even when I finished and walked away, he didn't know what the heck I was doing.
Well, Rich, I want to remind people that you are out on the road. You're coming to a town near people, wherever they are, and soon to be headed to Broadway. And we can't wait to see you there. We're thrilled that you still share your talent with the rest of us because you keep those great stars alive and you keep them in our culture. Plus, you show off your own stuff by doing some of these new people. The incomparable Rich Little. Thanks so much. Up next, take a ride on the back roads of America. This is Growing Bolder.
Stay connected to Growing Bolder for daily doses of hope, inspiration, and possibility. Find us on YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram for our latest stories, reels, and motivational memes.
Well, the next time you're planning a vacation and you really want to do something different, I mean, really want to see and experience things on a whole different level, forget about the highway. What you need to do is hit the back roads of America. Even better yet, if you do it on a motorcycle. Hey, our next guest did it, wrote a bestseller called Great American Motorcycle Tours that just celebrated its fifth edition.
in a very unusual way. So let's welcome one of America's leading travel writers, a sort of unusual guy, but one of our favorites, Gary McKechnie. Gary, great to see you, and glad that you're not on the road for a little bit.
Yeah.
So we can talk about it. I mentioned this book launch you had, and there was something about this launch that was very different.
Yeah, what was very different about it, I realized when the fifth edition was coming out, I thought, well, to really celebrate this, I wanted to do a literal book launch and a literary book launch. So I found this company out in Colorado, High Altitude Science, and they were nice enough to put my book under this weather balloon, and they shot it up into near space, nearly 90,000 feet up.
Yeah, if this was true, Gary, there would be video of it somewhere, obviously. Mm-hmm. Hey, look at that. Is that your book?
Yeah, that's my book. That's my book at about 16 and a half miles up over the Earth, and you can see the Earth like just sort of spinning in the background after the balloon popped. And it's really crazy. And I think when you're a writer like me and, you know, you get to the fifth edition and sort of the buzz wears off about it, you have to think of creative ways to market it. And I'm hoping this leads to a Nobel Prize.
That's not a special not effect. Sure. That's real, huh?
That's
so
absolutely
cool.
Yeah, that's absolutely real.
So you did a book launch by launching a book the first time in history.
Yeah, that's right.
Brilliant.
That's guy in history.
And that thinking is almost as cool as the thinking that went into the book. Because, you know, these days we have so little vacation time that when we get it, we try to plan every minute, every hour, every itinerary we have. But you say we're missing the boat.
Yeah, I think you are missing the boat. And a couple of things about that. I realized when I was a teenager that if I got 2 weeks vacation every year, I would work. If I extrapolated those numbers, I'd work 26 years to get 1 year of my life to myself. And at 14 years old, I'm thinking, well, that's not a good deal.
Wow, that's how it works. Say that again, because that's a great number. If 2 weeks a year, which a lot of people get, it takes 26
years to get 1 year of your life back. So that was always in my brain. And I thought, well, when I get older, when I'm not 14 anymore, when I reach manhood, I would try to do everything I could to stay free. And so that led by circuitous routes to the motorcycle book. And that really, the turning point was when I was hired by this shopping mall to write ad copy for the back of bathroom stall doors. So when an occupant would sit down.
What?
Yeah. The occupant would sit down, close the door, and they would see my ad right in front of them. I thought, oh, no. You know, if this is what my career has come to in my mid-30s, I can't do this anymore. So I just threw a Hail Mary pass. I said, what do I have to do to really experience America, to really feel empowered to take my life back? And that was the motorcycle tour.
So I'm sure there were some good experiences and some bad. I think we're kind of winding down here. What were some of the most fun things that you did?
Oh,
I mean,
gosh.
I can't imagine, you know, seeing Ma and Pa Kettle's house.
Well, riding down the Pacific Coast Highway, when you look to your right-hand side, driving down from Calistoga, then Sausalito, and then down the coast, and you look to your right and you think, you know, it's 1,500 miles away is Hawaii, and 1,500 miles past that is Japan. And it's just you on a motorcycle cruising along. And again, you feel like you're really engaged in life when you do that. That riding in the Vermont, riding across Kansas, riding down to Key West in Florida. And again, it's just taking your life back. And I think a lot of people need to look at themselves and do that.
We got to go, Gary. But do you plan or do you not?
I plan loosely and then try to forget the plan. And it's sort of like Zen motorcycling. I just want the experience to unfold.
It's so hard to do, but so worthwhile.
Once you do it, boy, you'll never go back.
Great stuff. We got to have you back.
I'd appreciate that.
You know, there's so much more to this guy that you will love. And for more about the great American motorcycle tours and his other great books, make sure to check him out at GaryMcKechnie.com. Isn't that great?
Well, folks, if you do decide to hit the road, you might be surprised at who is out there with you. The latest statistics from the U.S. Travel Association tell us that the average age of leisure travelers is now 47 years old, and 36% are over the age of 55. Surprisingly, only 8% are between the ages of 18 and 24. Here's something else I found interesting. 23% of all leisure travelers rely on friends and relatives to help plan their trips, and that's part of the reason Gary McKechnie's books are so popular. He's like having a friend who's taken these vacations and can help you plan exactly what you want to do. So be sure to check out Gary McKechnie's Great American Motorcycle Tours now in its fifth edition.
Up next, she's the first lady of rock radio DJs, and boy, does she have some stories to tell. This is Growing Bolder.
Embrace the health and longevity movement with the Fountain of Youth monthly e-newsletter. Growing Boulder and the National Senior Games Association have teamed up to bring you the latest videos, podcasts, and articles on inspirational masters athletes and the many benefits of physical activity delivered right to your inbox. Just go to nsga.com/connect to sign up for free today. The Fountain of Youth, because if you want to keep moving, you have to keep moving.
And our next guest has had a profound effect on the history of rock music. And as far as I know, she doesn't even play an instrument. So what is she? Well, since 1971, five nights a week, she's been a professional lifelong friend, an audio version of one of the best relationships you could ever have.
In other words, she's a radio personality, but not just any. She's the one who introduced Bruce Springsteen to New York, and she brought all the greatest bands and musicians straight to listeners on New York's Q104.3, on Sirius Satellite Radio, and before that, on WPLJ and WNEU. She's featured in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. She's been on VH1 and Entertainment Tonight, and she's written a very cool book about her experiences called Up All Night, My Life and Times in Rock Radio. Let's find out more from Carol Miller. Hi, Carol. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing okay. How are you guys doing?
We're doing great. Thanks very much. We appreciate your time. And, you know, when I was growing up...
Thank you for having me on the show.
No, it's our honor. We're thrilled to talk to you. When I was growing up in the 60s and the 70s, a radio DJ was pretty much a middle-aged guy with one of those comb-overs,
right.
You know, a striped shirt, plaid pants. Why did you ever want to become one of those? How did you get involved in it?
Well, I actually never thought that I would get involved in that because the... image that you just described was exactly what was around when I was a kid. I mean, he was just this really nice, goofy guy. And I just really enjoyed music. I thought it was fun. I was totally into the music scene when I was a kid. I saw the Beatles in person, and I did everything I could. It was kind of an outlet. And what happened was when I was in college at the University of Pennsylvania in 1968, the radio and music landscape had started to change. And people were taking, well, for lack of a better term, what's now called rock music, more seriously. It was a whole turning point. And I decided to just on a whim get involved in the school radio station, which went all over the city and is actually still there at the University of Pennsylvania. It's WXPN, which is, I believe, an NPR affiliate at this point. So I worked there, and I kind of changed my mission. I was going to medical school. I got in, didn't go, wound up going to law school. And while I was in college, the year preceding all this, I got a job in professional radio in Philadelphia.
So actually, this is a sad story because there are probably tons of lives that you would have saved had you become a doctor. Tons of people you would have got out of jail if you'd been an attorney. But no, you spent it all in a radio booth.
Well, that's a funny thing because... you know, you always say, what if? No matter what profession or what walk of life you've chosen, there are just so many what ifs. And you know the answer is you can't ask the question. It just doesn't work out because you can't go back, you know.
So you came at this with an entirely different perspective. I mean, as a woman, was that difficult for you back in the day? Was it exciting? Was it a challenge? How was it?
Well, I would say it was very difficult in that, well, first of all, I didn't even expect it to be a career. You didn't say, well, I'm going to have a career in radio if you were a woman. It sort of didn't exist. I mean, there were certainly women who did financial reports and women's type of shows, but just being an everyday host in a popular music area on, let's say, a mass appeal station, that didn't exist. And so I never really approached it that I was going to have a career in this. I really was set out to do something else, and this was going to be a sideline. But what made it the most difficult is what I think probably made the workplace difficult in just so many ways for women at that time, which was... Well, you know, if you looked halfway reasonable, just getting out of work in and out of the office without getting either propositioned or groped or so. You know, there were a lot of people, who, including many women in other jobs, who wound up having to change their job because there was a guy really, quote-unquote, bothering them. And there was nothing you could do about it. And that being said, I think sometimes, you know, the pendulum is swung the other way, where, you know, someone compliments someone on their dress and they feel offended, and they make a big fuss over it. But this was really the opposite. And in that environment as well, because, you know, the music is fun and everybody's supposed to be having a party, you put those two things together, plus a bunch of hippies coming in, and you have Mad Men versus, I don't know, Mad Men versus hair, and that's where you're working. You know, in an environment like that, it's a little tough.
And one of the things, Carol, that really, I think, drew people to you is that you were somewhere in the middle with that. You know, part of that was really enticing and fascinating. And you know, everybody knows that you spent a lot of time with Steven Tyler, with Aerosmith. I think David Coverdale from Whitesnake was in your life, too. I mean, you must have been hit on by everybody in the business.
Well, yeah, that's the case. But what I try to make clear in the book, and that really isn't even the theme of the book, was that the irony was that I came from, still do come from a very, you know, old world type of background. Many of us did. And that I had absolutely really no understanding of what some of these people were, some of these guys were after at the age that they were. I thought they were all looking for a wife. Well, I was kind of looking for a husband. That being said, though, outside of maybe one, couple of fellows that I really did go out with who were musicians, I really was their girlfriend, and it wasn't, you know, any one of those groupie things. I mean, I saw their house, we went to dinner, things like that, and I never really saw any crazy stuff. And to this day, you know, I am friendly with them when they come to town or they call, and et cetera, et cetera.
All right, we've had a lot of 60s and 70s rock stars on this program, those that are still touring, those that, you know, are just so thrilled that they can continue to do what they love. Are you surprised as a music insider that there is still a market, a big market that enables these people to still do what they like?
Oh, I'm not surprised at all. What I'm actually surprised about is that, you know, some of the music has fallen by the wayside, because my assumption was, well, you know, we're into the recorded era. Anything that has been recorded will be saved for posterity, and that music is kind of a continuum. You know, rock music is a continuum, that anybody who likes some of the new modern rock music will know, if not like, all of the previous rock music. So I'm kind of surprised that what has fallen, as I say, through radio, et cetera, has fallen by the wayside. But for people to be entertainers and pursue their careers, whatever they are, after all this time, it's great. I mean, that's what I try to do. And one of the things I think that we did get out of our quote-unquote generation is that, you know, we didn't have to turn into stiff upper lip older people. We could just keep going and being who we felt that we were, you know, without being childish, if you know what I'm saying.
Well, Carol, you've had an amazingly unique and fortunate view of some of the most popular, unusual, and interesting people of our time, and that's why we're really glad that you wrote the book. It's called Up All Night, and Carol, you're a treasure yourself, featured in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We're thrilled to have you tell some stories, and maybe we'll get together and do it again. Thanks so much, Carol. Stay tuned, because we're going to solve some of the biggest mysteries in the history of this country. The author of History Decoded is next. Sign up for the Growing Boulder Insider newsletter, delivered to your inbox every week. Be the first to see our latest interviews, stories, and tips for making each day count. Sign up today at growingboulder.com. Miss an episode of Growing Boulder Radio? Subscribe to our podcast and get it on your mobile device. Details at growingboulder.com/podcasts. Let me ask you a question. Do you believe alien bodies were recovered in Roswell? That Oswald acted alone in the Kennedy assassination? Was it just Booth that killed Lincoln? Did I get your attention? Because if there's one trait that seems to link all of us as Americans, it could be that we all love a mystery, a conspiracy, a puzzle, something we ought to be able to figure out but just can't seem to unravel. Well, we're going to meet a guy now who only not likes to try to decode mysteries. He's had so many fascinating twists in his own life that you could say he's a bit of a mystery himself.
That's a great point, Bill. Among other things, he is one of the premier comic book writers of our era. He's the number one New York Times best-selling author of The Inner Circle and 8 other best-selling novels. Both of his nonfiction books were bestsellers, too. He was co-creator of the network TV series Jack and Bobby, and you can see him on the History Channel as the host of Brad Meltzer's Decoded, which is the basis for his new book, History Decoded, The 10 Greatest Conspiracies of All Time. Here, folks, is Mr. Brad Meltzer. Hey, Brad, how are you?
However much they paid you to do that nice intro, I appreciate it.
If the interview was over, you'd be satisfied, wouldn't you?
I just want to hang up now and say, you know what, I'm going to go to sleep. That's as good as it gets.
Yeah, no. It's all downhill from here, Brad.
let's jump into this, because you obviously are a guy of many talents who can kind of poke us in many different ways. What made you want to dive into some of the most controversial and probably misunderstood events in our history?
Well, you know what? I think you just hit it on the head. It's because they're so misunderstood. That's what drives me crazy. I think we all love the game of telephone, but I hate to see when it happens with facts and history. And I've just been very lucky in my life. A couple of years ago, I had the family of John Wilkes Booth through their lawyer, who famously shot Abraham Lincoln, right? The killer of Abraham Lincoln. His family comes and reaches out to me and says, through their lawyer, "Hey, Brad, I want to tell you this story." And the story is that John Wilkes Booth, after he shot Lincoln, did not die 12 days later in a Maryland barn. He actually lived. He escaped. He went on and took on an alias, and he's not the one buried in the coffin. Would you like to hear this story?
Wow.
You better believe I wanted to hear that story. And so what the book does is it doesn't just count down the top 10 conspiracies throughout history, but each chapter actually has the proof in the book that you can pull out. So, for instance, when you get to that Lincoln assassination chapter, there's literally a secret compartment in the book, and you can pull out the letter that John Wilkes Booth wrote and left behind right after he shot Lincoln.
Very
and to me, it lets people look at the real evidence and say, okay, here's what I've heard. Now I can read the evidence for myself. We'll give you the will of the guy that they say is the real John Wilkes Booth. You'll see what his will said. You'll see who he left stuff to, and you decide if this will is real or if this is a family mistaken about who their relative is and what happened to him.
Well, Brad, if his relatives send you theater tickets, you might want to think twice about taking them. You know, aside from this Lincoln thing, and that was probably a bizarre twist of fate, but generations of authors, historians, investigators, they've all been trying to find the truth about some of these events nonstop. What else did you bring to the table that these other folks missed?
You know, listen, I don't want to come on the show and say I'm better than everybody else by any stretch. I think what we've really been, the hard part is you read so many of these books and they have agendas. They want to prove something. And it'll either be a book all about why the conspiracies are true or it'll be a book why they're all false. What we do in our book is we say, you know what, some are true and some are false. Some are real and some you have to really question and say, why won't they let anyone in Fort Knox? Why does the government shut it down? Why has no one seen the gold in Fort Knox since 1974. If it was so easy and to prove that it's there, just prove it. And that's a really good question. And what we do in the book is show you exactly that. So, for instance, when we do UFOs, you get the real government form that the government used to send out when you saw a UFO. You get the original Roswell report. We don't tell you what we think the Roswell report said. We actually give it to you. You see the redacted form. You can see what's declassified, and you can read that original report in your own hand. And to me, I think that's the difference. You know, when you get to the Kennedy assassination, we give you JFK's actual death certificate. And not only that, we give you the teletype from the State Department that shows that they were following Oswald and what they said about him many years after that and many years before he shot JFK. So to me, you know, hearing and getting to see those things, it makes it a really hands-on look at history. It brings history alive for you. And listen, I love giving my father-in-law a nice tie or some golf toys, but there's nothing like when I can give him a gift for Christmas of JFK's death certificate.
Folks, we're talking to Brad Meltzer, who is, among many other things, a historian and an author. His latest book, History Decoded, The 10 Greatest Conspiracies of All Time. Brad, as you know, the Internet has really exacerbated both sides of everything. There's more wackos out there now than there ever were. You're kind of the anti-wacko when it comes to conspiracy theories. You mentioned Kennedy. Did Oswald act alone?
You know, here's my belief, is I think that if you look, those three shots that Oswald fired, those were his shots. He was the one who pulled the trigger. There's no real proof otherwise. There's lots of great stories. You want great stories, you know, I can give them to you. But in terms of real proof, it's fascinating. And this is what America needs to know. When the Warren Commission first looked at the Kennedy assassination, they said three shots were fired, no conspiracy. When the House Select Committee a decade later looked at the evidence, they said, you know what, there is a conspiracy. And there were four shots fired. The fourth shot came from the grassy knoll. But here's what America needs to know, is that this fourth shot was based on an audio recording. It wasn't based on, like, physical evidence. It was an audio recording at the time of what they said, these two guys, two experts said, was a fourth shot. The amazing part of this, and this is the part that people need to know, is 3 years after that, 12 of the best forensics audio people came together and totally discredited those men. And they said they heard it completely wrong. The timing is off. The sound is off. And since that day, over and over, it's been discredited. But you know, we all know once you plant that seed of doubt, it grows into a forest. And right now that forest is on the grass knoll. I will say, though, there are important questions to ask. For instance, how did Jack Ruby get through all those cops? What was Lee Harvey Oswald doing in Russia for 2 years? 2 years in the home of our greatest enemy at the time. And the sad part is that part of history is lost because Jack Ruby shot Lee Harvey Oswald. And to me, that's where the real story is.
Hey, Brad, in our last minute, I'd hate to let you go without talking about this. I mean, you're such a cool guy, but people don't realize that you wrote your first book, you sent it off to 24 publishers and got 24 rejections. Can you share with us what did you learn about life, you know, in 45 seconds or so?
I can stick an extra minute because I want to tell you who I do think killed Kennedy. But I will say you are hitting it on the head. I got 24 rejection letters on my first book, and there were only 20 publishers at the time. I got 24 rejection letters, which means some people were writing me twice to make sure I got the point. But you know what? I believe whatever your dream is and whatever you do today, don't let anyone tell you no. Just keep going, keep pushing. Don't let anyone tell you no.
And real quick, who killed Kennedy?
So in 1960s, you know who killed Kennedy? We thought it was the communists. It was the Russians. It was the Cubans. In the 70s, time of Vietnam and Watergate, you know who killed Kennedy? We thought it was our own government. It was the CIA. And if you look at the 80s, the rise of the Godfather movies and giving way to Scarface, who killed Kennedy? It was the mob. So decade after decade, if you want to know who killed Kennedy, it's whoever America is most afraid of at the time. That's the amazing secret we forget to realize is, you know, JFK is the president that raised so many hopes, but in his death revealed so many of our greatest fears.
With anything Brad Meltzer's involved in, you know it'll be real pieces of history wrapped in intrigue and filled with aha moments. The latest book, History Decoded, The 10 Greatest Conspiracies of All Time, our thanks to Brad Meltzer. Up next, you think you know what it's like when you're sick? Well, you're about to learn what life as a patient can really be. This is Growing Bolder.
Stay connected to Growing Bolder for daily doses of hope, inspiration, and possibility. Find us on YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram for our latest stories, reels, and motivational memes. Our next guest, you will never again cancel a doctor's appointment. She almost didn't go to her eye exam, something that simple, but she did, and that's where her doctor discovered a condition that might have cost her her eyesight. Sounds like a good thing, right? Well, it was, sort of.
Good point, Mark, because that diagnosis kind of opened the door to what she says is almost like a bizarre alternate universe, almost like a rabbit hole of medical care. She says it was sort of like departing from the land of the well and winding up in this strange society set up for the sick. Everything from excellent doctors to those who were not so excellent, behind-the-times techniques to cutting-edge technology. It's all laid out in a very unusual book called Moonlight Sonata at the Mayo Clinic. Let's say hi to Nora Gallagher. How you doing, Nora?
I'm good. How are you?
Great. First of all, you went for an eye exam. What happened?
Well, I noticed a blur at the edge of my right eye, and I put off going to the doctor, which I want to tell everyone not to do. And about 2 weeks later, I went to my ophthalmologist, and he said, "You have an inflamed optic nerve." I didn't really know what that meant at that point, but, you know, the optic nerve has a kind of heavy sound to it, and he told me that if I didn't get it treated right away, I would go blind.
Wow.
Yes.
So you embarked on this amazing journey into the healthcare system, and before you tell us what happened and what didn't happen, I'm curious as to what led you to write a book about it. What's your background? Are you a writer, or is this something that you just were so motivated to do that you thought you'd give it a try?
I am a writer. I've published several other memoirs and a novel, so I approach the world by taking notes, and I started doing that with this situation, not knowing it would turn into a book, mainly to try to understand it. And that's when I realized I was living in a different country. As I walked from my doctor's office to the emergency room to get the intravenous steroids I needed for the optic nerve, I saw completely ordinary people on the street, someone talking on a cell phone, someone eating lunch, and I felt as if a glass wall had descended between me and them, that I was suddenly living in an entirely different country, only an hour after my doctor had told me I had this nerve inflammation. Somehow I knew that I had entered the, whatever you want to call it, the land of the sick. I ended up calling it Oz.
So, Nora, you went through this change immediately, and we all sort of can envision exactly what you're talking about, but you wrote a book because you feel like very few of us are prepared for what really happens.
I think that's the truth. I was not prepared, and I think I probably speak for a lot of people. When you get a cold and you have the flu and you don't really enter the land of the sick because you know that you'll get well. Although there's some familiarity with that land when you do have a cold. You know how you just feel like you can't move and other people are kind of running around and they have all this energy and you can't figure out why you don't? That's the beginning of this separate world that people in ordinary life are productive and busy and going about their business, and you can't. And I think it's very important to try to understand, especially when you're trying to deal with someone who has a very serious illness, that they are living in a totally different world, not only inside the medical system, which is pretty hard to get out of, but also just inside a world that is entirely different. It has its own rewards, oddly enough, but it's completely separate from the world where you're expected to be very productive all the time.
You make a couple of good points, Nora. And folks, by the way, we're speaking with Nora Gallagher, who has written a book called Moonlight Sonata about her experience inside our healthcare system. We say, because we've heard so many times, that we all have to prepare for what is going to be our major medical challenge, because sooner or later we are all going to have one. What did you learn about navigating our current healthcare system that you wish you had known before?
Well, there are a couple of just so basic points that I didn't know about. One is the famous 15-year rule, which is that it takes about 15 years for innovations in medicine to reach or to be put into practice by your local doctor. this is not because your local doctor is an idiot or because he doesn't have access to this information. It's because, like all of us, many doctors practice by habit or by the way they were taught in medical school. And so it takes them a very long time to change their practice or to use techniques that have been, you know, shown to be good in other places. So it's very important for the patient to become aware of new discoveries at a very high level. And it's a drag that the patient has to do this, but now that we have the internet, it can be done. So you need to know that your local doctor, while you might be a very good doctor in many, many ways, may not be practicing what is the most current medicine. And it's just a simple and unfortunate fact.
Nora, did you come out of this thing excited about our healthcare system, dreading going back in our healthcare system? Where did you see it?
I understood it now as a system that's being gradually taken over by efficiency experts who don't really understand what efficiency actually means and who are not working on behalf of the patient. That it sounds like a very bold statement, but I'm afraid it's true that. And the doctors are ensnared in that system as much as anyone else. We tend to blame a doctor easily because they're the person in the room. But the whole system is gradually being bureaucratized, if you will, to the point where it's very difficult to get what the basic needs of the patients are met. And, of course, when I was at the Mayo Clinic, that was a very different experience. They're not a perfect institution, but they are very efficient in many ways, but all of it to serve the patient.
You mentioned that you called this world in which you lived for a long time Oz. Unfortunately, there is no yellow brick road for all of us when we find ourselves in Oz. So what's the takeaway from your story? What can we learn from what you've experienced in the last minute that we have here, Nora?
I think the very basic thing is that to know that you're vulnerable is a very hard thing, but it's the truth is that we are all vulnerable and resilient, and the disorder is imagining that we're not. And that's actually a great gift.
Nora, it was a fascinating book. You know, I was kind of surprised looking through it. I wasn't sure what to expect, and you start into it, and it really affects all of us, whether we're totally healthy or not, because as Mark says, we're all heading to be part of that club and part of that country at some point. The book is called Moonlight Sonata at the Mayo Clinic, and as Nora said, she is a writer, and she has other works as well. You can learn more about this book and some of the things that she encountered along the way, and you can become familiar with some of the other writings that she has done by going to her website. Very interesting subject, folks. Make sure you take care of your health as best you can while you have it. The longer we can put off going into the healthcare system, the better off we all are.
We've heard from some pretty impressive people on this program, so now it's time to take a minute to think about you. What's your Growing Bolder story? What do you want it to be? Think about it, craft it, and then find a way to start living it.
Stop trying to define people by their age alone. It's a whole new world out there where it's not about age, it's about attitude, and that's Growing Bolder.
The Growing Bolder radio show is a production of Growing Bolder, LLC, all rights reserved. This program was recorded at Growing Bolder Studios in Orlando and is available as a weekly podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Spotify, and TuneIn. It is written and produced by Jill Middleton, Mark Middleton, and Bill Schaefer. Technical director is Jason Morrow. Production manager is Michael Nanis. And our most important team member, you. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram to keep growing bolder every day.